I will talk about cosmic structure formation. So the basic question of cosmic structure formation, I will shortly explain why it's so interesting. Then I will explain how we can analytically describe it, so understand it apart from doing simulations. And in the end, I will present a little bit on practical application, how to predict correlation functions both for dark matter and dark matter halos. So first, what is structure formation about? The big question is, how did the universe evolve from a hot, dense, but nearly uniform initial state into a final state which basically features structures on nearly all scales? So from stars, planets, galaxies to clusters, which are all aligned, what is called the cosmic web. And cosmology is providing an answer to that. So first, the initial stage was covered with primordial quantum fluctuations. And then inflation basically tells us how these primordial fluctuations get converted to the initial conditions for structure formation we can see in the cosmic microwave background. Then structure formation tells us how the quite uniform distributed initial stage seen in the CMB with this tiny Gaussian fluctuations got converted into this whole structure we can see today. So actually, we don't see the dark matter, of course, but all the galaxies are also embedded in dark matter halos, and we can see them in galaxy surveys. So what happened in a quite early universe? So inflation is an idea how to explain the initial conditions for structure formation. During inflation, we have a stage of quite rapid accelerated expansion, which establishes kind of the most boring initial conditions, namely homogeneity, isotropy, and flatness. And due to this accelerated expansions, the atoms basically cool down and can finally capture their electrons to recombine. And after recombinations, the photons decouple and can travel freely, which is exactly the reason why we can see the cosmic microwave background, which originated 380,000 years after the Big Bang, just today. And the CMB has been mapped by several surveys. So first it started with the COBE, then WMAP, and lately Planck. Basically tells us that it's a quite homogeneous distribution with only tiny Gaussian fluctuations of about 10 to the minus 5 in density contrast or temperature. So then structure formation sets in and basically converts this tiny, tiny overdensities into all the structures. So structure formation takes place hierarchical. That means the smaller structures form first. And via gravitational instability, the overdensities start collapse and attract matter and finally form bound structures. And dark matter is quite important for the stage of structure formation since it doesn't experience any forces counteracting gravity, such as radiation pressure. So that means dark matter forms the first structures and basically provides the environment for all the galaxies and clusters. So what is large-scale structure formation about from an analytical point of view? So in the first stages of the evolution, when we still have a density contrast which is below 1, so it started out with 10 to the minus 5, and when it's still below 1, we can describe it analytically because we are still in a linear regime. And we have a quite successful model, which is basically a pressureless fluid called dust model, and this is analytically understood. But as soon as we enter the nonlinear stage, this is so far analytically not really tractable, and we have to stick to n-body simulations which solve this problem numerically. So you see a small simulation here. Basically, tiny, tiny fluctuations in the beginning get converted into this nice cosmic web structure with all the filaments and voids in between. And what we want to have is a theoretical n-body double that is able to explain what is going on there and allows us to understand the basic features of large-scale structure.
Isn't that the n-body double?
No, it's an n-body simulation. And we want to have an n-body double, like a theoretical description, which explains it.
You mean analytic n-body?
Yeah, exactly. That's meant by that. So why is this so important, understanding large-scale structure? So cold dark matter is the main ingredient of our standard cosmological model. On the one hand, we have dark energy, maybe a cosmological constant, maybe something more involved, which basically doesn't cluster, so it's not a clumpy component. In contrast, cold dark matter clusters, and it can be assumed to be collisionless. That means those particles are interacting basically just gravitationally. And it has cold initial conditions, meaning that we can describe it using a smooth gradient field. And cold dark matter is especially important for large-scale structure, and all the baryons, which are then forming the galaxies, are embedded basically in dark matter halos, so galaxies and galaxies clusters. So from the one hand, it's interesting to understand large-scale structure formation because it allows us to extract cosmological parameters from galaxy surveys. On the other hand, numerical simulation provided lots of insights about the cosmic web and dark matter halos and revealed striking universal features like dark matter halo profiles. And we want to understand their origin analytically. So how can we describe cold dark matter and especially use the so-called Schrödinger method for this? So cold dark matter can be conveniently described using a distribution function. The distribution function encodes all phase-space information. And what basically happens, we start with cold initial conditions, meaning that we have basically particles sitting in some region of space. And due to gravitational instability, the outer particles will start to accelerate and pick up a velocity. And since it's a coherent infall, the particles starting from the right will move inwards, get a positive velocity, and the particles starting from the left will get a negative velocity. So we start out with this flat phase space sheet, which then slowly begins to bend. And as one can easily imagine, what will eventually happen, those streams falling inwards will eventually cross. This moment is called shell crossing. And after shell crossing, we have at one point different streams crossing each other. This is called the multi-streaming region, so you can see it there. And the theoretical task is to describe this behavior from an analytical point of view. And what we already did is we understand this using n-body simulations. So if you do an n-body simulation, you don't have a real phase-space sheet, but you have just particles which you can put into phase-space. So in an n-body simulation, we observe exactly what we are expecting theoretically. We have this phase-space sheet, it begins to bend, forms multiple streams, and in the end we get something like a bound structure, so a dark matter halo. And what is quite interesting, it has been observed by Widra and Kaiser, that one can actually use the Schrödinger method to model what is going on in an n-body simulation. So with the Schrödinger method, evolve it in time and plot it in phase space, you actually see that it resembles quite good what is going on in an n-body simulation. And this is what inspired us to employ the Schrödinger method, now from a different point of view, namely employing it analytically. And in the following, I will tell you how this is possible. So from a more theoretical point of view, what is the task for describing cold dark matter? So we can imagine cold dark matter is a huge collection of n particles interacting purely gravitationally. We can easily build a distribution function out of them just by multiplying delta function and subbing over them. But in the end, we want to get a continuous distribution function, so we have to perform an ensemble average. If we do that, we modify the equation. So we started from phase space conservation, which is just the Vlasov equation, and gravitational interaction is encoded in the Poisson equation. So it basically tells the gravitational potential depends on all the particles sitting there. So by doing this ensemble average, we pick up extra terms, which are collisional. But fortunately for gravity and a large collection of particles, they are suppressed by 1 over n. So we can safely neglect them. So the whole task of describing cold dark matter is about solving the coupled Vlasov-Poisson equation. And we could think, okay, perfect, we have now the right equation and we just have to solve it. Unfortunately, that's quite hard because the Vlasov-Poisson equation is on the one hand nonlinear, a partial, even integral differential equation, since the gravitational potential depends on the integral of the phase-space distribution function, and it has 7 variables. So as you can imagine, solving this is quite hard. So we have to think, how can we reduce the information contained there? And one nice part of reducing the information content is to say, okay, let's say we are not interested in the whole phase-space information, but just in spatial information. So let's stick to what is called the moments of the phase-space distribution function. We can extract the moments just by multiplying the phase-space distribution with momentum and integrating over it. So the zero of moment will just be the integral of f, which is just the density at any point. The first moment will describe what is the velocity, and the higher moments will then also encode what is velocity dispersion and so on. So velocity dispersion is quite important, and it's an extra term in the second moment, which is not related to the lower ones, so density and velocity. And this we call cumulant. And now we can think, okay, we have this reduced information content. Now, which equation do we have to solve to determine those moments? And we can derive it easily from the Blasov-Poisson equation, but what we observe there, what we obtain is an infinite coupled hierarchy. That means if I want to determine the evolution of the nth moment, I have to put in what is the next one. So now everything is about solving this infinite coupled hierarchy. So in the end, we want to have a closure of this hierarchy, but this is kind of difficult. So the easiest thing one could think of, okay, maybe we can just truncate the hierarchy at some point, meaning that we just neglect higher cumulants. And the only possible truncation of this hierarchy is at second order. This means neglecting all cumulants starting from velocity dispersion. And if I do that, I describe cold dark matter just using a density and velocity in a pressureless fluid model. And this is exactly what the dust model is about. I have just density at any point and a well-defined velocity. And then, instead of solving the complicated Vlasov equation, I can just solve the fluid equations for density, and my velocity can be assumed to be curl-free. So I just have to solve for velocity potential.
You could also have finite pressure, right? That wouldn't be called dark matter, but that would be a description of perfect.
Yeah,
right?
Would be also
so
true.
That's not the only possible truncation.
So, well, for you can derive the cumulant equation, and you see there the only possible truncation is at second order, meaning that you have to set to zero all higher cumulants, including velocity dispersion. And even if velocity dispersion has an isotropic term, which is with a delta, you have to set it to zero. Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. That's true. Yeah. So we can say, okay, that seems like a nice model. We have only 2 degrees of freedom, density and velocity. That cannot be too hard. Unfortunately, you can even think of it that this model will just break down at some point, because you have at every point a well-defined velocity. And of course, this can describe the initial stages of structure formation when the phase space sheet is still kind of a little bit bent but doesn't wrap up. But in the end, we want to describe this multiple streaming region, and this is just impossible with the dust model, because we have at one point, for example, 3 different velocities, and this cannot be in the dust model. So we cannot describe multiple streams, and for that reason also not the formation of bound structures with the dust model. So how can we do better? Let's see, where do we stand? We want to have an analytical n-body double, so we want to solve the Vlasov equation. And we saw there is a dust model, but it breaks down during shell crossing. So what can we do about that? There's a nice prescription which is based on the Wigner function. What is funny, if you build the Wigner function out of a self-gravitating field, which fulfills the Schrödinger equation, you can show that the time evolution really seems similar to the Vlasov equation. It's basically just the Vlasov equation plus a correction term. And then you might think, okay, the equations look similar, so possibly their time evolution is also. Unfortunately, that is not true. So although the equations look similar, their time evolution is not. But you can cure this issue just by saying, okay, let's not consider all the fine-grained information, but just consider a coarse-grained version. So I perform a coarse graining. Basically, I pick 2 scales which wash out the small scale structure, but are still less than the scales we are interested in. So I pick some smoothing scales, And that's quite interesting, because if I compare to an n-body simulation, I always compare to something which is coarse-grained, because the n-body simulation has a finite resolution in phase space. And the nice thing is, if you coarse-grain the Wigner distribution function, you get a quite good emulation of the coarse-grained Vlasov equation. So now, instead of solving the coarse-grained Vlasov equation, we can stick to this Wigner approach, and in the end, we can solve a Schrödinger equation. And their time evolution is in good correspondence, as has been analyzed basically from a totally different point of view, namely by asking what is the correspondence between quantum mechanics and classical mechanics. So the correspondence between coarse-grained quantum mechanics and coarse-grained classical is quite good. And that's exactly what is behind the Schrödinger method.
I have a question about these singularities. If you have a fluid continuous distribution of matter, so how do these singularities come about?
Again, please.
How do these singularities come about? You have a fluid.
Yeah, the problem is basically when the phase space sheet begins to bend, eventually you have a point where it's just perpendicular. And if it's perpendicular, your density will have a singularity because you somehow integrate over the slice. And that's exactly what it's about. Yeah, true. So the idea is now, how can we use this Wigner approach to solve the Vlasov equation? And the Schrödinger method basically tells us we can just model cold dark matter using a self-gravitating field. And a self-gravitating field is a wave function. We can easily determine it using an amplitude and a phase. And if this wave function fulfills the Schrödinger-Poisson equation, so namely it's not an ordinary linear Schrödinger equation, but a non-linear one, but the potential is determined by the wave function itself. If this wave function fulfills the Schrödinger-Poisson equation, we can construct a phase-space distribution out of it. Quantum mechanics just tells us how to do it, namely...
A is a scale factor there?
Yeah, A is the cosmological scale factor. Exactly, yeah. Should have mentioned that. So we have this wave function from the Schrödinger-Poisson equation, and now the question is how can we determine the phase-space distribution? So the first part is the last one, which is marked in red there. It's just the Wigner distribution. It tells us how we can build a probability, so a quasi-probability distribution, from a wave function with this quite special momentum dependence, which will become important later on. But this Wigner function is not a real probability distribution because it can go negative. And we have to account for that by coarse-graining the whole thing about small scales. Basically, in quantum mechanics, this coarse-graining is ensured by the uncertainty principle. And here we have to impose the uncertainty principle just by hand because we have no real quantum mechanics here. So h-bar is just a free parameter, not really connected to the value in quantum mechanics a priori. And this tells us how to build a distribution function out of it. And we are now ensured if the wave function fulfills the Schrödinger equation, then the distribution function constructed in this way will solve the Vlasov equation plus tiny corrections.
I might have a pointer there as well.
Oh, maybe that's good. Okay, be careful in the first row. Yeah, so now you could ask, okay, we have this model, but there are like new parameters in there. So except for the 2 degrees of freedom, the amplitude and the phase, we have 3 new parameters, namely h bar and sigma x and sigma p, so the 2 smoothing scales. So let me first tell you what the smoothing scales are about. So the coarse-graining scales basically determine what is the fundamental resolution. And we have to choose them to basically stay in the semi-classical regime. So we have to choose them accordingly to h-bar. And this h-bar, the Schrödinger scale, has a twofold role, which is quite interesting. So on the one hand, h-bar controls to which accuracy we are solving the Vlasov equation, because the corrections are controlled by h-bar. So you might think, okay, let's choose a real small h-bar, and maybe we want to send it to 0 in the end. But if you send h-bar to 0, your ansatz will also be different, because this ansatz also depends on h-bar. And what actually happens if you send h-bar to 0, you just recover the dust model. So you have to be careful. We want to have a small h-bar, but we cannot send it mathematically to 0. And a way we can understand this role of H bar is we can take the Schrödinger equation, do this split of the wave function in amplitude and phase, and now we can ask what are the equations for amplitude and phase, which come from the Schrödinger equation. And if we derive them, we see actually they look like the fluid equations, but have this extra term here, which is sometimes called quantum potential, quantum pressure, or quantum velocity dispersion. So at this point, you see if you send H bar to zero, you have just a dust model back. So we want to keep H bar because, as I will show later, it's quite important for regularizing the singularities and being able to describe these multiple streams. So now that I presented basically the background, let me convince you that this model indeed works. What we... Which delta?
Oh, the delta.
Oh, yes, a Laplacian, yeah, of course. Yeah.
I guess the thing that seems a little surprising is that in the end, you do get something which is just described by 2 degrees of freedom at every point. And I would have thought that in the Schrodinger equation picture, you would still need some sort of hierarchy of moments to keep a track of, some sort of pulse phase based information.
Exactly. So, the interesting point of the Schrödinger equation is although we have only 2 degrees of freedom, we have still all cumulants there. And basically the secret is the cumulants are encoded in spatial derivations of the wave function. So if I have quite rapid oscillations of the wave function, they encode the higher cumulants. Exactly. So it's basically a reorganization of the information, which is quite convenient because you have only this spatial degrees of freedom. Exactly. So why does this indeed work? So let's see. What we did here, we solved a one-dimensional example just to be sure that the Schrödinger method is actually able to describe multiple streams and in the end also the realization. So I will show you there just a phase-based density. On the one hand for the Schrödinger method, which is marked in blue, and you will see basically not a thin phase-space sheet, but a little bit extent, and it's blue shaded a little bit. That means we just plot what is the amplitude there using this color scheme. And on the other hand, we will also show the so-called Zeldovich solution, which is basically the dust model. But in the Zeldovich solution, you can somehow propagate through the singularity in density and evolve it through. But as you will see, the dust model is perfectly fine in the first stages, similar as the Schrödinger equation, but after the moment of shell crossing, it will start to deviate. So let's see. We start with this phase-based sheet, which slowly begins to bend. And now we see, oh, we approach the moment of shell crossing. So the moment of shell crossing is right now, when it's really perpendicular. And now you will see the tiny red line, which is the dust model, will just fail afterwards. Why the Schrödinger method stays well behaved and is really able to describe these multiple streams. So we have multiple streams in the Schrödinger method. Now we can say, okay, that's nice. So if it's possible to have these multiple streams, will we eventually see something like virialization, so halo formation? And indeed, this is also possible. So just a speeded up version, evolve further, so moment of shell crossing, multiple streams, and you see the dust model will just fail, and now we turn it off. And you see there are several shell crossing happens, and slowly but surely we're approaching something like a stationary state. So in the end, we see a virialized halo. So indeed, the Schrödinger method seems to be able to capture the key effects, namely multi-streaming, and is therefore also able to describe the formation of bound structures. So what is the secret of the Schrödinger method?
When you say Zeldovich solution, this is just what people call Zeldovich approximation, where everything has a fixed velocity, basically.
Yeah, but for the 1D case, it's even, the exact solution. Yeah.
It is like...
In 1D, yes.
No, but it doesn't go around.
Yeah, exactly. So it's an exact solution, but the reason that it starts deviating, you go through the singularity, and afterwards you have no guarantee.
It's not an exact solution.
It's not the right solution, at least. Yeah. Exactly. So apparently we found our n-body double, and now we have to employ it analytically. So we have to discover what is the secret of it. And as I mentioned, quite important are the cumulants. So we have to close the whole hierarchy. So we have to tell what are higher cumulants like velocity dispersion. And they have to be encoded in this phase-based distribution. And now there's a nice property, namely the special momentum dependence allows us to calculate all cumulants just analytically. So we have 2 degrees of freedom, amplitude and phase of the wave function, and we can just give formulas for all cumulants just in terms of 2 degrees of freedom. So the special momentum dependence is quite important, and we can just compute the cumulants. And we see the lowest cumulants are just related to amplitude and phase. And it seems as if the amplitude is basically given the density, except for the fact that we have to coarse grain over it. So it's like a microscopic density, and we construct a macroscopic one out of it. And then we have this velocity. So somehow, the phase seems to be a velocity potential, but we have to construct the physical velocity by multiplying with the density and coarse-graining over it, and then dividing by the coarse-grained density. This will simply give us a mass-weighted velocity. And that's exactly the key behind it. Of course, at any point, you will have one velocity, but that's not a fluid velocity, but only a mass-weighted one. So at points where we have a positive velocity and a negative velocity, we will just get zero as a mass-weighted average. And all higher cumulants I can also construct out of this method, and they are, of course, given in terms of density and velocity. And what's so nice about that, I just have to solve the equations for density and velocity, and by that, I automatically solve the whole hierarchy. So the higher cumulants are given self-consistently, which indeed allows us to close the hierarchy and not truncating it. And that's quite interesting. So let's see if the cumulants have nice properties. So what we plotted there, so shortly remind you of the evolution that takes place, single stream regime, first chair crossing, multiple streams. So first chair crossing happens around A equals 1 for the scale factor. And we plotted here basically a cut through the phase space density at some point in space. And then we showed what are the cumulants as a time evolution. So you see the blue curve just gives you the velocity. And as you can imagine, velocity is always important. But velocity dispersion and the third cumulant are not important until shell crossing. So before A equals 1, you see the two curves here are basically not relevant. But immediately after shell crossing, not only velocity dispersion, so the magenta line here, becomes important, but also the next higher cumulant. And that basically tells us we won't succeed with the dust model because velocity dispersion is missing. But even if we say, oh, let's add some velocity dispersion by hand, this won't help because we have to take care of the whole hierarchy and determine the cumulant self-consistently. And that's the secret behind the Schrödinger method. We have all cumulants present. They are, of course, restricted because they are connected to density and velocity. But they have the key feature that they become equally important after shell crossing and are dynamically sourced. So that is basically the secret of the Schrödinger method. So let's summarize. The Schrödinger method is a nice tool to describe a theoretical and analytical n-body double. The dust model is nice in the first stages, but will fail after shell crossing. But the coarse-grained Wigner approach, which is based on solving the Schrödinger-Poisson equation, is able to describe multiple streams and even halo formation, which is relevant for large-scale structure. Okay, so this method is nice. Now, how can we investigate the effects analytically? The first thing we did as an application to investigate the effect of the coarse-graining, because the coarse-graining is quite important in the Schrödinger method. So as a first application, we derived a dark matter power spectrum, just sticking to what is called the coarse-grained dust model. So we know that the dust model is a good approximation in the early stages. So let's just stick to the coarse-grained dust model, which is also a limiting case of the Schrödinger method if we send H-bar to zero. So it's quite interesting to study it. And as I mentioned before, the dust model is quite successful, and we can just solve the equations perturbatively. Just step by step, take the fluid equations, perturb around the background, and yeah, we can just do ordinary perturbation theory in expanding in the density contrast and something which is related to the velocity divergence. And from that, we can just derive the power spectrum if we stick to Fourier space. And why the power spectrum is interesting? The power spectrum is connected to the correlation function. So the two-point correlation will basically tell us what is the excess probability of finding two objects separated by a certain distance. And this correlation function has nice properties if we have a background with isometries like homogeneity and isotropy. It's just a scalar function. And it's quite important. So let's see, what does this excess probability mean? If we would have a random Poisson distribution, the correlation function will just be zero because it's random, so there's no preferred radius. If we have a non-random distribution, so some radius where there are more particles, R plus, and some radius where there are less particles, R minus, then the correlation function will have an excess, so a peak here, and a defect at another point. And if we forget dark matter and say, okay, we are interested in the correlation function of, for example, galaxies, this will provide quite some insights, because for galaxy correlation function, we will actually see for dark matter, it would be boring. Basically, we have a peak here and it just goes down there. But for baryons, we have this baryonic acoustic oscillations, which are basically caused by the radiation pressure, pushing outwards and giving an analog of sound waves. So they will see this BAO peak, and you basically use the correlation function to infer cosmological parameters.
This is the correlation function for dark matter.
No, that's not. So dark matter would be that. Basically, it's halos.
If there's no baryons in the universe, then that would be true. But I mean,
exactly. But if you have baryons, you have this baryonic acoustillation peak.
This is also imprinted in dark matter.
Yeah, sure. It's in the end also imprinted in dark matter because the baryons have a back reaction. That's true. Yeah. So we want to understand this because it's quite important. So if we just stick to dark matter, the power spectrum is basically tells us about the correlation function because this is just a Fourier transformation. And if we compute the density power spectrum in perturbation theory, we just see a specific feature. So the power spectrum in linear order will go down at high k, which is on small scales. But if we take higher perturbations into account, it will go up. And now we can ask, okay, we had this coarse graining there. What is the effect of the coarse graining?
And this perturbation theory was more bounded equilibrium, so that it blew up, I think.
Yeah.
This looks like it's just giving some smooth contribution, which is important.
Yeah, this is density power spectrum.
I think it all depends on the scale that you're plotting. Yeah. That's 10 orders of magnitude difference.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
If you look at percent difference, then of course that's very big.
And an issue in perturbation theory is if you take higher and higher perturbations into account, it won't converge. So that's an issue. Yeah. But now we are just asking what happens if we coarse grain the dust model and what one would expect. If we are coarse graining, we are removing power on small scales, and we will see this just by the power spectrum going down. So this is a trivial effect. So this finite resolution effect, namely the coarse graining, manifests in bending down the power spectrum. But there's also another quite interesting effect, namely I talked about this mass-weighted velocity. So by doing this coarse graining, we don't have an ordinary velocity, but it is mass-weighted. That means I coarse grain the product of density and velocity. And thereby, I pick up something like vorticity. So even if my microscopic velocity is curve-free, the mass-weighted one won't be, because we have just the product, and we have to compute what is the vorticity of that product, which is coarse-grained. And what's quite interesting, you can just compute it using ordinary perturbation theory, construct a vorticity, and compute a power spectrum. And as you see here, if I turn on my smoothing scale, I turn it from 1 to on 4 megaparsec, what will happen? If I make it bigger, then vorticity becomes relevant at larger scales, which is intuitive. If I coarse grain on a bigger scale, vorticity will be also become relevant on larger scales. But the shape seems to be quite universal. And what's interesting, if you compare it to an N-body simulation, what you observe there, depending on the mass resolution, your curve is also shifting, but in the end, you will converge. So if you increase the mass resolution, your vorticity power spectrum will converge. And if you compare those two curves, you basically see that you get the best match for smoothing of 1 megaparsec. So that means we can explain what we are observing in an N-body simulation as a large-scale vorticity, which is not related to multi-streaming or something like that, just by having this coarse graining in mind, which is kind of interesting. So the coarse graining basically just removes information on small scales, but also induces some features like a large-scale vorticity. Yeah.
Calculate the power spectrum from a transfer function based on by Eisenstein group. You have to introduce an initial power involved, which is normally assumed to be k to the n, n about a 1 scale. So how do you see this initial behavior for small scale?
So what we basically did, so we put in the linear power spectrum predicted by a lambda CDM.
Just lambda CDM.
Yeah.
Which does what I just said.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Okay, so this is the first part, considering real dark matter. Now we can say, okay, we have this coarse-grained dust model, and this could also be true for halos, because for dark matter we have no real preferred smoothing scales, but for dark matter halos the story is different. So maybe we can apply this for inferring the halo correlation function, and in the end we want to compare with the galaxy surveys, and surveys are performed in redshift space, so observations are not done in real space. So how can we describe this? So there we don't stick to Eulerian perturbation theory, what I presented before, but rather to the Lagrangian framework. In the Lagrangian framework we describe everything using the displacement field. So we think of it, we have particles at initial positions q, and they are displaced with this displacement field to give us the final position. And this displacement field is quite nice to describe it perturbatively, and Lagrangian perturbation theory is really better than the Eulerian one. And then in the end, we have to tell what is the map between the displacement field and the density. And it's a quite nonlinear map. So two parts, first doing perturbation theory using the displacement field, and then we have to infer the density from that. And we can do this based on the Zeldovich approximation, which is quite successful. So the Zeldovich approximation is just first-order Lagrangian perturbation theory to determine the displacement field. And for first-order perturbation theory, we can do this relation between density and displacement field non-perturbatively. And by this, we have kind of a physically motivated resummation of standard perturbation theory. And it's a quite good description for halos. And we can even improve the prediction compared to N-body simulation if we don't take the ordinary input power spectrum, but if we smooth it on some scale. And this is then called a truncated Zeldovich approximation. And what we did, we took an N-body simulation, marked all the particles sitting in a final halo, and traced them back to the so-called proto-halo. And now you could ask, I now use the Zeldovich approximation to determine the displacement field for the proto-halo, and I can apply a smoothing there. And now I can ask, which smoothing scale gives the best prediction of the displacement field? And you would maybe guess that the smoothing scale has to be connected to the scale of the halo. So basically the size of the halo will tell you on which scale to smooth. And that's exactly what we observed. So if you take the proto-halo, smooth at the Lagrangian radius, so basically the size of the halo, and infer the displacement field using the Zeldovich approximation, you will actually improve the prediction. So for halos, it's quite interesting. We have a preferred scale to smooth on, and we can improve the agreement with n-body simulations by that. So the idea is now the right theoretical implementation for this is precisely the coarse grained dust model. So what we have to do is to determine Lagrangian perturbation theory for the coarse grained dust model. And there, the effect of the coarse graining will be not that simple. So it won't be just smoothing the input power spectrum. But we have to carefully determine what are the effects of the coarse graining. And we did this with a nice application. Namely, in the end, we are not interested in first-order Lagrangian perturbation theory, but we want to push it to take it higher order. So this is then called post-Zeldovich approximation. And as I told you, in the end, we are performing observations not in real space, but in redshift space. And redshift space will be affected by peculiar velocities.
So far, you haven't actually used the Schrodinger method.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right?
That's just connected to the coarse grained dust model, yeah. No H-bar whatsoever. That's true. So if we consider redshift space, the peculiar velocities will affect our observation. And if we imagine we have a circle in real space, it will be squeezed due to the velocities in redshift space. Here we ignore gravitational lensing. Just take the peculiar velocities, which are parallel to the line of sight, into account. Okay, so we now have to think about combining the real space correlation function and the velocity information to infer the correlation function in redshift space. And there is a nice model for that, namely the Gaussian streaming model, which just tells us, in order to predict the correlation function in redshift space for bias tracers, so for example, like halos or galaxies, we have to determine the real space correlation function and the velocity statistics, and then can just employ a Gaussian convolution of real space correlation and the velocity statistics. And the several ingredients, real space correlation and the velocity, basically the mean and the variance, can be inferred from perturbation theory. So what we did, we took Lagrangian perturbation theory for the coarse grained dust model to infer the parameters, and then put them back to predict the redshift space correlation function. And what you observe there, if you are just doing Lagrangian perturbation theory with a slight improvement, which is called convolution Lagrangian perturbation theory, but yeah, let's skip that for the moment. And we compare, on the one hand, the real space correlation function, and on the other hand, the monopole of the redshift space correlation function. So we can just take redshift space correlation function, separate into different Legendre moments, just using the Legendre polynomials, we see that the monopole will basically look similar to the real space correlation function. And it's quite good, predicted by a convolution Lagrangian perturbation theory based on the ordinary dust model. But the story is different for higher poles of the redshift space correlation function. So if we really want to predict the quadrupole or the hexadecapole, it is much better to stick to this coarse grained dust model. So let's see here. I compared the quadrupole and the hexadecapole, normalized by some bias factors, which basically helps you that all the mass bins will overlap. And as you see here, in blue, we have the prediction for ordinary perturbation theory based on the dust model. So you can see here. So the quadrupole seems kind of, it makes sense, but already the hexadecapole will basically fail to reproduce what you see in an n-body simulation. If you now do the coarse grained dust model and employ an overall coarse graining scale of 1 megaparsec, it's a slight improvement for the quadrupole, but for the hexadecapole, it does not really help much. But what is quite interesting, if you do a hybrid smoothing, meaning that for part of the model, so on the one hand, correlation function and velocity statistics, you perform a smoothing on 1 megaparsec scale. And for the other part, you perform the smoothing on the Lagrangian ratios, where we observed that it really improves the agreement with the simulation. You actually are able to really improve your prediction for the higher poles of the redshift space correlation function. So the message is just you can improve the prediction of the dust model by coarse graining it and by adjusting the right smoothing scales. You actually really can improve especially higher poles of the redshift space correlation function. And apart from this model, which just employs different smoothing scales, there's another improvement of the dust of the Gaussian streaming model, which is possible. So the Gaussian streaming model basically uses just this Gaussian distribution. And as you can imagine, there must be non-Gaussian corrections. And you can take them into account by performing an Edgeworth expansion. Basically, you expand around the Gaussian. And what's quite interesting, if you just generalize the Gaussian streaming model using the non-Gaussian correction terms and just use the first correction, you actually see that you are improving a lot on small scales. So we compared here the consistency of the Gaussian streaming model, which was just done by, on the one hand, measuring the, this is the quadrupole, directly from the n-body simulation, and on the other hand, measuring in the n-body simulations the parameters, put them into the Gaussian streaming model to get a prediction. And as you can see here, the Gaussian streaming model is quite accurate, so from scales from basically 30 megaparsec upwards, it's quite fine, but on smaller scales, it will fail. And what's quite interesting, if you just take the first order non-Gaussian correction. Oh, that's basically the ratio between the prediction of the Gaussian streaming model with measured parameters to the real value, which is measured directly. Gaussian streaming model in the lower panel. No, no, that's not related to any coarse-grained or dust model, because you just say, I have these parameters, and I directly measure them in the n-body simulation. So that's really separate, just telling you how accurate is the Gaussian streaming model itself.
Could you explain again what Gaussian is
doing? Okay, let's go back. Oh, there was it. The Gaussian streaming model tells you how to predict the redshift space correlation function from the real space correlation and the Gaussian velocity dispersion, which is basically, yeah, concentrating on the pairwise velocity, its mean and its variance. So you have basically three ingredients there, and usually they are just predicted from a perturbation theory or whatsoever. But what we did here, we wanted to see, is the Gaussian streaming model really working? So we just inferred these parameters from the n-body simulation. Yeah, of course, they're a function, but you can still measure them in an n-body simulation.
I'm just wondering, in what sense is this a model? Because it seems that on the left-hand side, you just have, you have a two-dimensional function, and the right-hand side, you have, I guess, two two-dimensional functions.
Yeah, but those functions are only in real space.
So is the one on the left?
No, the one on the left is redshift space.
But that's a two-dimensional function.
Yeah, true.
So I can always come up with a two-dimensional function there at that perfectly.
No. No, because this has, for example, no non-Gaussian correction. So it's a real restriction to basically say, so you see, here your observation in redshift space is not really encoded. The, yeah, basically the translation from real to redshift space is all encoded here.
But so, the sigma bind 2, that's the two-dimensional function.
Yeah.
When you fit for it, you actually fit for a two-dimensional
function, or not? So it's a function of R and R parallel, so 2.
That's my point. The point that your observable on the left-hand side is a two-dimensional function, and the right-hand side you have a free two-dimensional function, which is sigma bind 2.
Yeah, but still, you cannot fit it perfectly. Otherwise, you would just see that the accuracy stays well-behaved. It's a real restriction to claim that you can describe it using this Gaussian distribution, even if you have scale-dependent parameters
but,
there.
I mean, the thing is that the left-hand side is just the cumulant of the distribution. You could just a second order cumulant. So in principle, if you want to describe all the cumulants using a Gaussian distribution, then that would be a problem. But if you're just looking at one observable.
But those are different. So the redshift space correlation function has different poles. So the monopole, the quadrupole, hexadecapole is all in there.
But so does sigma 1, 2, side. Yeah, and anyway, so maybe I should let you go on. I'm a bit puzzled by the fact that, I mean, you have the same number of free parameters in some sense as what you're trying to describe, because sigma 1, 2 is a two-dimensional function, but psi is also a two-dimensional function. But maybe we should move on.
Okay, yeah, maybe let's talk later about that. So what you actually see that if you don't stick to the perfectly Gaussian streaming model, but include non-Gaussian corrections here, you can actually improve the accuracy on small scales. So let's go just back. Yeah, as you see here, even if you measure the right parameters from your n-body simulation and plug them into the Gaussian streaming model, the accuracy will be given up to 30 megaparsec, but will fail on smaller scales. And if you just include the first non-Gaussian correction, that's highly non-trivial. So if there is like a deviation from a Gaussian distribution, there's no guarantee whatsoever that the first non-Gaussian correction will really make it better. But this is what we observed here. So if you include just the first non-Gaussian correction in this so-called Edgeworth streaming model, you improve your prediction basically up to down to 15 megaparsec. So two parts we're working on. One hand is the prediction of the parameters from perturbation theory, which improves if you take the coarse-grained dust model into account. And on the other hand, a totally different streaming model, which includes the first non-Gaussian correction, improving the accuracy on small scales. So let's wrap up. What did I tell you about? First, I talked about the Schrödinger method, which is able to model cold dark matter using a self-gravitating scalar field, which just fulfills the Schrödinger-Poisson equation. So instead of solving the whole Vlasov-Poisson equation, we can just stick to the Schrödinger equation. And it provides us with an analytical tool, since we are able to infer all cumulants just analytically. And as I showed in the one-dimensional numerical example, it is indeed able to describe multi-streaming and even halo formation. So let's see the video again. So shell crossing and dust model fails, but the Schrödinger method stays to be a good model. Then I talked about the coarse-grained dust model, where we kind of forget about the Schrödinger method and just took one ingredient, namely the coarse graining. And we observed there that a quite specific feature of the coarse graining is causing a mass-weighted velocity, and thereby you pick up a large-scale vorticity, which is also true in n-body simulations. In the end, I talked a little bit about the halo correlation in redshift space. So on the one hand, we generalized the Gaussian streaming model to take the first non-Gaussian correction into account. And on the other hand, we improved the prediction for the ingredients of the Gaussian streaming model, sticking to something similar to the truncated Zeldovich approximation, so by just employing a smoothing scale. So what are the prospects, especially concerning the Schrödinger method? On the one hand, we would be really able to perform a perturbation theory based on the Schrödinger method. We could disentangle the limitations which are usually in the analytical models. Because on the one hand, you have the limitation because you stick to the dust model and you lose all higher cumulants. But on the other hand, you are also limited because you are not able to solve the dust model directly, but have to stick to perturbation theory. And it would be quite interesting to disentangle, is the main limitation due to the dust model or due to the perturbative treatment? On the other hand, since we saw that the Schrödinger method is able to describe halo formation in principle, it could be interesting to infer halo density profiles from it and somehow understand what you observe in n-body simulation, so a real striking universality concerning halo density profiles, pseudo-density profiles, and stuff. This would be quite interesting. Yeah, path of research. On the other hand, the Schrödinger method gives a tool to investigate different dark matter models. So on the one hand, you could say, okay, the Schrödinger method, we don't take it as an approximation, but as a fundamental model. If you would say this, then you would describe something like an axion. So basically something like wave-like or fuzzy dark matter. And this has interesting consequences, for example, concerning dwarf galaxies. So on large scales, it really resembles what is going on for cold dark matter, as I showed. But on the other hand, it has real effects on smaller scales. On the other hand, you can even include warm initial conditions, or even non, so first relativistic neutrinos that become later non-relativistic, by just not solving the Schrödinger equation, but the Klein-Gordon one. So basically, the Schrödinger method encompasses several points. On one hand, a fundamental model, something like wave-like dark matter. On the other hand, a nice tool to really resemble what is going on for cold dark matter on large scales. So thanks a lot. I'm ready for questions.
Perfect timing. So just before taking questions, a couple of notes. Sukhara will be here until the end of the week.
Yeah.
Her office is
226.
226 next to Dada's office, so if you want to find her later and talk to her. And also, we're going to try to have dinner at some point this evening around 6:30 in the bistro. So don't hesitate to join us. So, questions for Clara. Dada.
So, you talked about understanding Taylor universality here and after we. The Schrödinger system has a scaling symmetry, and you might think that you can use that to understand results at different coarse grain ends as you change the scaling parameter. And it's really the quantum effects, the quantum pressure that destroys what where you normally have self-similarity. So that destroys the self-similarity of the Hilbert density profiles, but have you thought about using the scaling symmetry as a way to understand the origin of self-similarity in cold dark matter? So as you change that scale parameter, that enforces self-similarity up to the quantum scale.
Yeah, actually it's totally interesting. So as I mentioned, that if you send h bar to zero, you recover the dust model, and h bar is connected to the phase space resolution. You could also think about, okay, somehow it could be that if I let H-bar flow, I have something like a phase transition between do I have halo formation or not. And what we also observed in this numerical example, that H-bar is quite important for if you are able to form structures. Because if you choose H-bar too big, then basically it will take a long, long time to form the structures. And if you decrease H-bar, you will see structures forming more rapidly. So I think that's quite interesting concerning, on the one hand, what happens if I let H-bar flow, and which is also connected to that, what happens if I let this moving scales vary.
In the self-similarity you're thinking about, even for the nonlinear Schrödinger equation, you're saying it's something where you scale away from the same kind of scale
to the coordinate? Yeah, it has this special scaling symmetry. So you scale the wave function by the square of the scaling parameter and the spatial coordinate by 1 over the scaling parameter, and then
Yeah, what is also interesting, for example, in an N-body simulation, they measured what is the probability of finding a certain value of the phase-based distribution function. And they basically observed that the probability of finding a certain value is quite good described using a power law. So basically, probability of finding a certain value of F is just F to minus 2.5 over, I think, quite huge range. And there are lots of those, yeah, striking things. I hope that some of them are somehow.
Although that kind of depends on your coarse graining of skin, because you don't actually observe the fine grain.
Yeah, of course, it's in a coarse grain set.
In some sense, in CDM, the phase space density should be conserved, so whatever it was at the time of decoupling dark matter from ordinary matter, it should be just that.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that it's not quite clear, but I mean, do you have any idea about how to get that from?
So for a density profile, I think it would be most promising to search stationary solution of the Schrödinger Poisson system, possibly also with symmetries. And there are also some kind of self-similar solution of the Schrödinger Poisson system. And I think it would be quite interesting to look into them and try to derive a density profile out of them. Yeah.
More questions for Cora? If not, I can ask one more question. So there is this program, I guess, a few weeks ago, we had, for example, a talk by Senatore, Leonardo Senatore.
Effective field theory
approach to structure formation. So that's another approach, and in some sense, it feels somewhat more systematic approach to dealing with basically this coarse graining schedule, basically non-linearity in the structure formation. I'm just wondering what you think about that, and don't you think that's the better way of basically approaching the nonlinear effects? Because, I mean, the perturbation theory just, in a strict sense, always breaks down as
that's
you form
true.
The first
Absolutely.
Structures, right? So whenever you're talking about larger scale structures, you do have very nonlinear objects that are always present. So you don't have the perturbation theory in any sense, I mean, valid in a strict sense. So, and I guess the idea is that this effective field theory approach that provides a way of dealing with those nonlinear structures that are always present is for granted at that level. So do you think, do you think that's the right thing to do, or do you think you have an alternative way of approaching that problem?
So basically, I would say there are some links to this effective field theory. Of course, if you're really interested in nonlinear structure, you have to do the effective field theory and ask for basically, yeah, all the extra terms you pick up by them. But on the other hand, if you think like, if you're doing real effective field theory, in the end, what you have to measure is all the parameters in an n-body simulation. And I think somehow it is connected. So on the one hand, in our model, you have to choose the smoothing scales just by hand. And of course, there's no universality as in this effective field theory approach where you say, okay, I have to do renormalization and stuff. But on the other hand, I think it's not so different from each other because you have to measure their parameters and we have to fix the smoothing scale. And what's actually quite interesting, so for this vorticity, you cannot get a prediction for the vorticity power spectrum from this effective field theory, but you can predict the spectral index. I think I have somewhere. Let's see. Yeah, there it is. So what we also did, we computed the spectral index, which tells you basically about the shape of the vorticity power spectrum, which you can also derive from effective field theory. And we plotted it here for three different smoothing scales, 1 to 4 megaparsec. It's a different color scheme than before. And what we observed, it's quite similar to the values predicted by effective field theory. So basically, you have the range of the spectral index between 3 and 4, and it's quite similar what we saw here. And another interesting point, so what is usually done, if people argue about vorticity, they say, okay, vorticity is generated due to a mass weighting of the velocity. But if you don't have a coarse graining, you have no means of calculating it. And what they usually do as an approximation, they say, oh, we take the curl, not of the velocity itself, because this will be zero, but we take basically the curl of the product of density and velocity, so something like momentum. And by that, you also get a prediction. And what's quite interesting, so the spectral index looks totally different. So this is the spectral index for this usual approximation, and this is the spectral index for the real coarse graining. And as you see there, just by taking this ad hoc thing, you won't really get what is going on there. So there are basically two things. On the one hand, the usual approximation is not really well describing what is going on. And on the other hand, it seems to have real links to this EFT approach. Yeah.
So the numbers there is from that paper.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And it's also similar in this n-body simulation. So for the n-body simulation, of course, it's different because you can also infer for lots of smaller scales. And they basically observed that the spectral index starts, I think for them, around 3.5 and goes eventually down to minus some value. Of course, you cannot infer this from EFT or this perturbation theory approach. But yeah, I find it somehow surprising because it's really a different approach, but still has some links.
The edgewalk expansion might be a different way of different orders of effective
field theory. Maybe, yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you. No more questions.
Thank you.